the old 20th Century Fox logo. This is Steve Hopkins. I'm the director of Predator 2, or I was, in 1989. And we're just about to embark upon a helicopter shot right next to the Dodgers ground in L.A. Coming up over the hill and seeing sunny downtown Los Angeles. The opening sequence we're about to see is all shot from a helicopter with police infrared camera, which looks like a big round black ball, and it's what the police used to use, even in those days, to follow vehicles at night and to look into people's buildings if they felt like it. We saw some good stuff flying around with the police. And what we did is we took all the gray scales presented on the monitor of the infrared camera, and we gave them color motifs in terms of heat. And Joel Hynek, the visual effects supervisor, he designed this new system. And bang, we're in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. We shot this for 3 or 4 days, I think. And we've sort of entered in those days what was supposed to be kind of futuristic, in a very sort of Latino-dominated downtown L.A. with gangs and Jamaicans and stuff. It's a bit more glamorous than the real life down there, I think. I think we were pretending this is probably around about now, just around the year 2000 or later.
Horribly wounded in a deadly crossfire, the police seemingly unable to rescue them in spite of several desperate, heroic attempts. It's completely out of control down here.
It caused chaos down there. Had this whole street knocked off for a couple of weeks. And we haven't yet met the heroes. This is the first hero coming along now, I think. Actually, amongst all this was a TV celebrity then called Morton Downey Jr. This is a big, huge explosion that we shot. We put a telegraph. We dug a hole in the street and put a telegraph pole into the street and exploded it, shooting it up, knocking the car in the air. We had to be very careful because of the buildings and stuff, so it looks much more impressive than on film, I hope, than it really was. Here's Morton now. Morton Downey was a TV, sort of the predecessor to Jerry Springer in a way. But he had kind of fascistic views about life in America. But he got caught, I guess, got caught in a scandal, sort of creating the news. He brought in Nazis and brought in all these, you know, people onto his show who turned out to be not real, turned out to be actors, and he got caught and thrown off the air in the end. But at this point, he was quite a celeb, and we thought it'd be fun to have him in. Danny Glover comes charging in. I really wanted Danny from the beginning because I just thought he was been so good in the Lethal Weapon films. And this is a Joel Silver movie and a Larry Gordon movie. And they'd done, at this point, they'd done the first Die Hard and they'd done the first Lethal Weapon films. The first one, I think. And I always thought Danny was such a good actor. It'd be interesting to have him in a film like this. And joined by Ruben Blades, who's a wonderful actor from Panama and a great singer, a big rock star down there. Almost became the country's president at one point. And Maria Conchita Alonso.
And where the hell is that weapon? They're still tied up in that shootout in San Pedro, getting their ass kicked by the Jamaicans.
We paired Maria up with this great policewoman who we found from downtown LA, who was so similar to her and really gave her lots of great advice. And she was a part of a group of police downtown who only investigated black magic murders. And so we asked her all about stuff like finding dead bodies, and she said she'd found whole warehouses full of dead bodies hanging in plastic, which being sold off for satanic rituals, which I thought was pretty grotesque. Almost a film based on that. Danny's taking out the big guns. Here he goes. There's quite some stunt sequence coming up here. We storyboarded this in real detail for obvious reasons, because is so complicated. And Danny had this fantastic stunt double, who was a good friend of his, who did all his films, even though Danny's doing all this hanging out of stuff himself. It's a really good sequence. At one point, when we first started this film, I'd been talking to Danny and Arnold Schwarzenegger. At one point, they were going to do it together, the film. But in the end, I think Arnold was given the choice of doing this or Terminator 2. And I can see why he chose Terminator 2. It was such a fantastic movie. But it was a pity not to have had them in the movie together. God knows how many rounds of gunfire happened to the ridiculous opening sequence. This is now a set designed by one of the many designed by Larry Paul. We're back on the Fox Studios now shooting this sequence. The music is by Alan Silvestri. It's the first time I worked with him. He'd done the first Predator film, and we recorded it up in the George Lucas Sound building up in Lucas Valley in San Francisco with a huge orchestra and all these interesting Brazilian collaborators who were doing all these bizarre percussion instruments, underwater drums and strange pipes. It was quite an event.
Yeah, let's get the rest of them. We can't. We just got orders from Chief Heineman. He says secure perimeter, surround building, and wait.
Wait? For what?
I don't know. Some bullshit special unit. The feds. The DEA.
Hey, we let the feds get dug in now. We let the level building to get them out.
There's so much cursing in this film. I remember when we had to do an airline version, they sent me about 3 pages of 4 columns of curses that happened. We had to cut out of the film. The film must be about 20 minutes long on the airline.
Come and get it!
Henry Kinji, he's a great stuntman and quite a good actor. I've worked with a few times, I'm sure. Anyone who's worked in Hollywood has worked with Henry. I wonder now downtown if we'd be able to get away with this kind of filming anymore. It was so rough and location bound and helicopters hovering over buildings. I think if the laws are different now, we wouldn't be able to get away with this stuff. Back on stage for another big shootout, or the continuation thereof. Peter Levy, my Australian cohort, was the director of photography on this. And we were also lucky enough to grab this great camera operator and steady cam operator called Jimmy Muro, this kid who was willing to throw himself around and has since become quite a star in that world, shoots small Michael Mann's movies and all the great steady cam stuff. Peter and I decided to shoot this movie a bit like a Western. We thought that, we'd come from Australia together. We'd been working there for a while, and he's an Australian, I'm British, but I lived in Australia for a long time and worked there, and we decided that Los Angeles, with all its kind of glare and dust, especially downtown, felt like a Western town to us. It felt like a sort of a mining town that had been shoved up really quickly. And so we decided to shoot it with this kind of yellow, dusty look, this tobacco look. So that's our first view of the Predator coming up.
Freeze! I said hold it! Now lay your guns down. It's over. You can walk down or fly. It's your choice. I said put it down, asshole!
And there you go. In the first movie, The Predator, they'd done a version of the creature, which was pretty extraordinary at the time, but and we had time on this one to really to finesse it. And we did it with a different, a very, very complicated system, and then a different system. But this was maybe the last big special effects film ever done on film. You know, Joel Hynek, the visual effects supervisor, was telling me everything was going to go digital, and I didn't know what he was talking about. And I think there are something like 700 or 800 visual effects shots in this film, some very complicated. And doing them on film is so crazy. You know, having done many films since with digital effects, it's just a different world now. You can do this so much easier than what we had to do, how we had to do it then. I remember seeing a pirated copy of this that someone sent it to me from New York while I was editing the film, as happens all the time, which just drives you crazy, where all the sequences just have Kevin Peter Hall, who played the Predator, in giant red and blue suits running around on green screens and blue screens. It's just awful.
Okay, search the roof, work your way down, check every floor, maybe someone else.
I don't think Danny Glover had done a film like this before. I'm not sure if he's done a film really like this since, where he just plays an out-and-out kind of tough cop hero. It was great to see someone with his kind of gravitas get into this. I remember being told by the special effects guy on the floor, Richard Foreman, that I don't think ever used so much blood on any film. I remember walking around this set, we were just spraying it around the place. But actually, it was really the police consultant who told us if these things had happened, how much of the blood there would be on a location like this, which is pretty revolting. Bullets, blood, and cocaine everywhere. It's a good 80s movie for you.
So, what happened to the Scorpio?
Oh, he's out front having lunch. What the hell is this?
I don't know. They've been cut to pieces. Must be the Jamaicans.
This time, but where the hell did they go? Okay, nobody gets in here until forensic arrives. Nobody. Okay, you know the drill.
I remember at the time, I think the Jamaican gangs were making quite a splash in New York, and they certainly had been in London, which is where I'm from. In fact, I was born and brought up in Jamaica. And so I think that's why we kind of fixated on them as a kind of interesting style of gang to have. Stan Winston, of course, created The Predator, and really finessed it for this second sequence, and has constructed many fabulous dead bodies over the years. Later on, I did Ghost in the Darkness with him. We did lots more death and destruction. This Predator, the costume is much more detailed than the first one, because we were going to see the creature a lot more. You know, it's always good to disguise how a creature looks in a movie like this nowadays. You know, I guess these creatures, you very rarely will see a human being inside a constructed rubber suit. It'll all be digital nowadays. But it's a great job, and Kevin Peter Hall was such a great mime artist and a great physical actor. And he was 7'3" or 7'4", I think, but in the suit he was about 8 foot tall.
You let me down, Mike. You're making me look bad. I thought we had an understanding. I put my ass on the line to get you here. And all I expect is a little cooperation! Now, you were told that this was a federal matter. Yet you disobeyed a direct order to stay out of the building.
Don't let this get out, Phil, but it's a fucking war down here.
You're a soldier, and you take orders. I'm not pushing. I'm pushing as far as I can every day, Phil. So we're fighting for our lives down here. I do now, Tom. Pushing to the moon.
Joel Silver is involved in this film, so of course there has to be some fabulous helicopter arriving and landing in an inopportune situation. And here comes the government after Robert Darby has chewed out Danny Glover, Adam Baldwin, and crew members, and of course Gary Busey, turn up to sort this out. Gary Busey's character's name is Peter Keyes, of course, was the name given to Truffaut in Close Encounters. And there are a team of guys who've come in to investigate this new predator.
What's going on here, Hahnemann? Insubordination. Disregard for direct orders from the supervising officer. Now get back to your cage at Alvarado. I'll show you in the woods.
It is like a Western, isn't it? The sheriff being told how to behave and all the politics. So this is the future we pretended to see, and strange enough now, I guess, we seem to have these concrete barriers around town. There's some great architecture in downtown LA, some forgotten stuff from the 20s and 30s and 40s. A lot of which are empty then. I think downtown's become much more gentrified now.
Five members of one Colombian drug gang were apparently ambushed by their bloody rivals, the Jamaican.
Marilyn Vance did the costumes for this. I worked with her a few times. She did a great job of just trying to, you know, we have so many extras in the film, trying to create this world. But I have to say, these hookers look a lot like 80s rock sirens to me, just then. Bill Paxton. What a laugh. He's so much fun. He's done a couple of movies with Jim Cameron at this point, and he's really sort of busting out as this kind of interesting, rebellious, funny actor. And he's had a great career since, I think.
Hahnemann's already been up my ass so far, I won't be able to sit down for a week.
We're not winning this war. As much as it's going to piss you off, you're going to have to play the game on this one. That diva meeting.
Kent McCord. I guess it was a big TV star, wasn't he? It's Adam. I can't remember the name of the show now. But everyone was very excited when he walked on set. I guess they'd grown up with his TV show.
Full cooperation. Which means you're cutting off my dick and shoving it up my ass.
God damn it, Mike. The feds are calling the shots on this. My hands are tied.
Yeah. Captain Pilgrim. Peter Keyes.
Well, it's good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Lieutenant Mike Harrison.
This is the first film Gary had done after a dreadful motorcycle accident that he had, where he'd hit the road really hard and was in hospital for a long time and actually died for a while. And this was a film, first film he'd made for a couple of years after that accident. He's quite a character.
I wish I could tell you more. We have a large number of deep cover operatives involved here. You know how it is. We all have a job to do. Now, I'm sure we can respect each other's situation and act responsibly.
Well,
going around Gary and Danny was quite intimidating for a little fella like myself. I'm about 6 foot or 6 foot one, but these guys are just big, huge guys. Gary's enormous, and Danny's about 6 foot three, and they are exceptionally big, tough guys.
Lieutenant Harrigan, I'm in a transport. Harry Lambert,
have a seat. I'll keep you right here.
What's this dude?
Yeah, what an asshole.
Seen this TV station in so many films since. I'm not sure if we were the first people there. I seem to remember we were, because I think it was pretty empty when we arrived. But we're doing this kind of futuristic retro thing, which always looks good on film, I think. And, you know, Larry Paul had done some great movies, and he'd been the production designer on Blade Runner and all sorts of wonderful films. So it was really fun to work with him.
Waited until the last minute, and then took out four men armed with machine guns by hand, and then got by us. Maybe we should give him a job and put him in the payroll.
So me and my partner bolt up the stairs. Somebody is screaming bloody murder. You got it.
Hey, I forgot to tell you. See that guy there? That's Ferry's replacement. This guy's Jerry Lambert. The Lone Ranger from Rampart Station.
That's the Lone Ranger? I thought he was here to fix the air conditioner.
I said, lady, you are under arrest. And she said, why? I said, because your husband is dead, you killed him. And you know what she said without missing a beat?
No.
She said, and I said, that son of a bitch plenty of times. He never died on me before.
We thought it would be fun if Bill just went right over the top with his character. And he's just, he's got the right temperament and style to do it.
I haven't heard about you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
Like your last Barney got shot? Well, if you try that cowboy shit with me, fucking, you can kiss this. Goodbye. Got it?
Yeah, I got it.
Well, well. I see that the three of you have met. Lambert, if you're feeling up to
it. It was interesting. Yeah, the first Predator movie was really quite a fabulous comic book, but because it was set in the jungle, you can get away with all sorts of extremes in terms of character and comic book styling. And we try to do the same thing in the city, and sometimes it's really fun. Sometimes it's a fine line to draw, because you're supposed to believe what's going on, and you're in a situation that's much more familiar. We've all seen movies about cops and tough guys, and it takes place in a city, in an urban environment we're sort of familiar with. So the same style was sometimes hard to kind of put into such a different environment.
Looking to prove himself. I won't stand for it. Now, don't get me wrong.
Mark Goldblatt was the editor on the film, who's pretty much a genius of action movie editing. If you go back through his list of credits, extraordinary stuff. We worked with Cameron on Terminator and the Lethal Weapon films. And we edited this film on film, which is, I think, the last film edited on film, I think. After this, we went to working on Lightworks. This is a great set. This is Gerald Silver is a Frank Lloyd Wright aficionado, and we did this big sort of Mayan faux Lloyd Wright set in a penthouse in L.A.
This has gone too far now, huh?
Some pretty fabulous costumes coming up in this scene.
I know you're trying to scare me, huh? Oh, you did a pretty good job, man. I'm scared now.
Sorry, the girl on the floor, his name was Terry Weigel, I think, went on to becoming one of the most famous porn stars in the world, I think.
This is our boss, Power. A new king in the streets. This is the message he has for your people. You are.
This gentleman with the dreadlocks here is kind of a tough guy. He wasn't so much of an actor. He was like a Jamaican from Kingston, and I don't think he'd acted before, but he had tons of charisma. I would have worried about him, I think. Mind you, he's wearing gold trousers.
What the fuck are you doing now, man? You're crazy!
This poor actor had to hang upside down for ages, and because of course you can't keep them on the side table for more than a minute or two before they start, getting ill. So he had to get up and down with the poor guy. And I think we had a stunt double for sometimes for him, so he didn't get stuck up there for too long.
Fucking voodoo magic, man. But you know what? I tell you what I believe. Shit happens.
Ugh, that's gruesome, isn't it? It's amazing how violent and how crazy this was. I guess I don't really see films like this anymore. I think in this film, if there's a set that's beautifully designed and set up, it's going to be destroyed. It's a part of the fun of these kind of movies, I think. It was fun how we were allowed to have so much extraordinary style in this film. And here come the new weapons designed by Stan Winston and myself and some of the guys there. We wanted to figure out a whole new bunch of stuff that he had we hadn't seen before, so he fires these nets with pincers that fix into the wall, and we decided we would see his new weapons, one of which is this lance. First time we see him become the Predator. From the beginning, we decided to make sure that we kept, we didn't see too much of him. Oh, here's George Christie, the famous journalist who popped in for the day and shot some stuff for us.
It might be the fear Jamaican voodoo posse.
So I go in for my physical, right? And the doctor says, I need a semen, stool, and urine sample.
Now, this is a car park in downtown LA, and we were supposed to have a few nights to film, but we only had one night in the end, some budgeting schedule nonsense. And I made a terrible mistake. I remember Reuben Blades was being interviewed, and actors are being interviewed all the time. So I was waiting, the sun was coming up, and there's a shot coming up where we have cranes on top of cranes on top of cranes, which involved Reuben. And the sun was coming up, and I was about to lose the whole sequence. So I went out looking for him, and I couldn't find him, and there he was being interviewed, so I dashed over and I said, Reuben, we've got to get going. And I pulled the earphone out. And I said, we've got to shoot this. We've got like half an hour to shoot this whole sequence before the sun comes up. And the DP's going crazy. And I didn't realize he was being filmed live on Good Morning America. So I went to bed that day, slept through the day, woke up that night, and there were about 30 messages in my answer machine. And I'd on live television, I'd ripped his earphone out and dragged him off and apparently cursed and all sorts of terrible things. So I was this monstrous guy. So the next, after shooting the next night, Reuben and I had to go into a stage and I had to explain why and apologize to Joan London, which is, it was amazing. For weeks after, they get people coming up the street and sort of congratulating me or whatever. Got famous for about 10 minutes. But Reuben was great, because it didn't look like it was a slur on, I didn't care about actors or Latin people or whatever. It was just silly, just came out all wrong.
Hard out. Terror tactics, man, scared the shit out of their enemies.
So I had to build lots of bodies, lots more blood to hang into this set. I think Stan Winston said he'd never made so many dead bodies for one film.
Round the terror gangs, Fred Woodsiega in Jamaica. Julie got too powerful. The Jamaican chiefs won't make a move without his approval.
So what the fuck happened? Shit!
Hey, we got a survivor!
What's she saying?
Here's Terry. She did a great job, actually. She was stuck on this set for weeks. Screaming and covered in blood. It was an awful thing to have to do.
Shit, if the Colombians did all this, then why'd they leave their boss, Ramon, over there hanging tan and his girlfriend naked on the floor?
It wasn't the Colombians.
My friend from the armory.
Right. We got a new player in town.
Come over here, Mike. Check this out. What is that?
Looks like a beer tip or something.
This is a restricted area. I want it cleared.
We shut all these stage sequences at Fox, 20th Century Fox, on Pico, in Los Angeles. I remember it was the first time I'd ever shot on a big studio lot, and it was very exciting for me at the time. I'd done a couple of movies, which, tiny movies, and I'd never had all these toys to play with, these money to build these huge sets. And then suddenly, one day you drive into 20th Century Fox, and you feel all cool and super professional, and you get to work with some great film people to build all these huge sets and have all these lights and have all this stuff available. It just brings back those memories right now. I thought I'd hit the big time.
Wait a minute. I got my rights. I'm a journalist. Harrigan!
Shut up. Let's go.
Smells like a camera. The press has a right to know.
Take him out of the building.
You're a scumball.
You get the hell out of here.
Who the hell are you, Keys?
The last person in the world you want to fuck with.
Adam Baldwin's a terrific actor. He'd just come off doing Full Metal Jacket for about a year and a half. Had some great stories of working with Kubrick on that. He and his guys had been in Vietnam, kind of in South London for the last year and a half, where they built Vietnam. So this was a change of pace for him.
Don't worry, Lieutenant. Surveillance is my specialty.
Okay, then. Just keep going.
Go get him, Long Ranger.
Hey, Danny, look here. We gotta take this real cool. These guys sure aren't the DEA. But still, Jesus, party. You stick around. Stay out of
sight. There you go. You see the sun coming up in the background? That's why I had to grab Ruben Blades right there.
Hey, wait for me.
Danny boy, no hero stuff, understand?
Dead boy. Dead boy.
Watch your ass, Danny boy.
She never made it. The feds were waiting. Hustled her off in a chopper.
Let me guess. Silver Alouette?
That very one. Guess what? Your pal Keys was running the whole show. And his butt boys.
You done real good, kid.
I think it's one of the first movies where video was used a great deal. And you'll see later on there's all these video sequences where Gary Busey's guys go in to find a predator with cameras on the shoulders. I guess Jim Cameron had done it in Aliens. And we've just taken it a few steps further here. We reused it a lot. It was when video was the technology existed to start filming video off TV screens and stuff easier.
Hey! Are you both okay?
Fine.
How are yours?
Hey, do you mind? My sister.
Hey, what?
Oh, you're not my sister, are you? Son of a bitch. Who are you really, Jesus?
I guess we felt we had to spell it out for the audience a bit. This scene seems very expositional. Now, this is the shot that took so long to set up, and this is the shot I did after I grabbed Ruben off TV. We had a giant crane with a Luma crane on top of that, and which is on top of a vehicle which moved and followed him, so it's a very noisy sequence, so all of this sound is put in later. This whole sequence here, which we had to have for the film. All these funny little gadgets invented by Stan Winston or the props department. Try to make it all feel natural, and it wasn't necessary. Sometimes you knew exactly what these gadgets did, but this just seemed to be a natural part of the police sort of equipment. Music's so important to this film. I remember Joel Silver taking me to see the first Predator film, and showed me a 70mm print, and then in the soundstage where we mixed this, and then just removed the music from the first film, and it's amazing how the music just gives all these images so much power. And Alan once again came in and just puts so much atmosphere and tension into stuff that really otherwise it would be seen quite mundane, or scenes that you feel like you might have seen before. He just gives a different accent to. Cliche now, but I guess nowadays you expect the guy who's set up to be your hero's partner might be the first one to face. Death. But I guess it's not so much about trying to surprise people with story. It's more how you execute it, I guess. Very difficult sequence to storyboard the sequence. You had to try and work out how to tell the audience this story without really seeing anything. You know, so when Reuben Blades grabs out for a purchase to try and hold himself up, he grabs onto something that's invisible, and then you have to try and see it turn visible, and you can't, even when you do the reverse and see what it is, you can't see the face of the creature because we're desperately trying to hide it until the big finale. Even though the new costume and the details were so much more complete.
Violence prone, obsessive compulsive personality, a history of excessive physical force throughout his 18 years as a Los Angeles police officer, also responsible for the...
I guess we thought in the future a computer-generated female voice would be telling you all about the characters in your police office. Didn't really turn out like that, did it?
My intervention on your behalf are the only reasons you still have a job, Harrigan. If it were up to the chief, he'd charge you with Detective Archuleta's death and suspend you. As it is, he left it in my hands. Now this John Wayne attitude, flagrant disregard for policy, is going to end now.
There's no Gosh, one... this seems like one too many scenes telling off Harrigan for being a loose cannon, doesn't it? I think we get that.
No one. That's it.
I think while trying to make the film look glamorous, we're all trying to give it a sort of realistic look in a way, you know, as where things weren't too beautifully lit and they feel remotely real in a world that's obviously not real.
They can't keep the department out of it.
No!
We'll find Danny's killer.
Captain, Danny and I came up together. 15 years on the fucking street. Whoever killed him is going to pay. I'm going to finish it.
Gosh, I remember this building in downtown LA, and I've seen it many times since. It's an old courthouse, I think, or an old city hall building. And if you look around TV shows now, you'll see it usually with a big federal emblem on the floor of some type, because there's this round atrium in the center.
I don't give a fuck who you really are, what you want with this asshole, because now it's personal, and he's a dead man.
The concept of what you're dealing with is way over your head. I'm warning you.
You don't know what you...
We did this scene a bunch of times, and I think both actors ended up kind of rused. Well, Gary certainly did. He wasn't going to complain about things, but I remember him, he just got shoved up against that marble column by Danny so many times. And Gary didn't want to play soft with it. He wanted Danny to really be rough with him, and I think he regretted it a bit.
We're too close.
Claiming as his turf already controlled by the bloodthirsty Jamaican and Colombian drug force. Watch.
TV's everywhere. I guess that has sort of become true, isn't it, in a way?
LA is up for grabs. The spoils of our once fine city going to the ruthless scum who can spread the most carnage and blood in our streets. Our latest update on the scoreboard.
And journalism seems to have ended up very... We seem to have hit the journalist thing pretty good, too. So much TV journalism is like this now. It's just hearsay and guesswork and opinion.
I meant to say to your personal little war, you know. I love Danny, too.
And he told me, Lieutenant, the only way you survive down here is because you're a team. The door swings both ways, remember?
All right, we'll do it together.
Okay, the film's going to get serious now. They're going to get the Predator, that's for sure.
Been on it for the last 3 days.
And they're not looking for drug dealers.
Yeah, they've been setting up these weird radar sensors all over downtown.
So he chose this period of cars, which was interesting, sort of 70s cars. And even though this is supposed to be the future, you still get a sense of period. Because downtown LA doesn't really change that much, you know, in terms of... It does in minutiae and in atmosphere, but visually it just sort of stays the same. It's kind of been left alone for a long time. Lots of hats. I remember Joel wanted people to wear hats because he thought, he thought the world was going to become hotter and hotter, which I guess global warming is true, and he thought people would start wearing more and more hats. Right? And some parts of the world, that's true now.
Omega 1.
We're going to need an extension over here.
It's Omega 1.
Please make sure.
Okay, we've only got 20. Here we go. We're into video hell. I can tell you, 1989, getting this to work all in one sequence is quite a deal. I think we had something like 30 monitors with 20 operators of different three-quarter-inch machines, which all had to run at certain times, and it's not like now. We can just do it through one digital box. It was a nightmare, especially when you're trying to do shots like this where you're going across multiple screens and they all have to have some sort of coherence to them.
You have approximately 20 minutes to finish your task.
Good. Roger, increase this UV. About 42%.
We were looking for slaughterhouses all over LA, and I saw some pretty gruesome stuff in lots of them, but we ended up just getting a big warehouse and building it as if it was a slaughterhouse. That's where Keys and his guys are.
He was boned like a fish. I've never seen anything like this. Please, do not touch anything.
Doctor, what about the other victims? Anything there?
The federal team brought in their own forensic examiners. I am the medical examiner and the chief pathologist in the city, and they've cut me out completely.
Any way you can get a look at any of the evidence the feds have collected? I mean, they must have run tests.
It won't be easy.
Doctor, I pried this from Danny's hands. This is what took him up into the raft.
All these beautiful details of these little bits and pieces there. So beautifully designed. And they have a sort of identity with the Predator's costume, which was, you know, combinations of metal colors and gold and brass colors. And so everything had this great feeling to it. Stan Winston and his guys just spent so much time really working the details. That was what's so extraordinary. That's why the company, I think, and they're so successful. I think in lots of ways now, the creature creation stuff is really an industry and a craft of the past, because everything's done digitally. And I remember at the time, Stan was already making plans to go into the digital world to enhance the work he was doing.
King, will ever see you now.
These Jamaican dudes are hilarious.
It's okay.
Don't you want me to go with you?
I'll call you.
Then he goes to meet Calvin Lockhart.
I'll call you later.
Do you think we're a bit over the top with that limousine? I'm not sure.
What? 1-8-8-8.
Oh, fuck! That's very gothic, isn't it? I think being British, I always tend to go a bit gothic. And there's, you know, downtown, there's some great Art Deco buildings downtown, and we went a bit Chrysler building with them. We put up big gargoyles and stuff. I remember drawing out ideas for the poster with the Predator and the gargoyle, and they sort of did a different version of that for the poster in the end.
Thanks for the ride. You know, you guys really ought to cut down.
What a fabulous, creepy alleyway. I remember we cleaned this down on 7th Street, and we cleaned this alleyway out, and we put water in it, and put our own garbage in it. But, wow, this was a tough neighborhood. There were people throwing bottles at us from the window because we were making too much noise. And they were also filling paper bags with their own feces and throwing that at us as well. So the crew would be running back and forward, trying to hide out. And we were apologizing, and... It's Calvin Lockhart. People will recognize him from some great 70s movies.
They say you on top to me. They say you offering me favors.
This is where the sheriff meets the mystic.
Why, Babylon, Mr. Policeman.
I want some information.
Information? About the one that's doing all the killing, I have.
He killed your people. Now mine. I think you know who he is. I want him.
I don't know who he is, but I know where he is.
This scene is so much fun.
The other side.
It's so over the top.
The spirit world. You see, it's always the same.
Calvin threw some mean bones. I remember we were trying to get stuff when he threw the bones to land in a certain style that would look extraordinary. I remember just the first time he did it, it just landed great. We thought, oh, we don't need to shoot anymore.
It's killing your people and mine. It's from the other side. I can feel him all around. You can't see the eyes of the demon until him come calling. This is Dreadman. Truly great.
It's one of Alan's great cues. All these Brazilian dudes just going crazy in the studio.
Time to go.
It's one of my favorite special effects sequences coming up. We spent a long time working on this. It was terribly complicated because every time we shot the Predator, we'd have to shoot him in different colored suits. Red, blue, green, over and over again in the same sequence, and then often again on blue screen for months after shoot, after the main shoot. And so what we'd do with each suit, you'd get motion control and you'd match the suits up so they had a sort of fractured personality. But we put the water in because I always thought it'd be kind of fun to see the Predator, that when he walked through the water, you know, because the water in the first film interrupted his invisibility process, that we thought in water we could see him reflected in the water but not visible otherwise. And we had these air jets under the water which were in the shape of footprints, and we'd follow that across with steady cams, and later on we'd shoot the Predator walking in front of the motion control camera the same way to match the jets. And of course the water changes invisibility, but we saw him reflected for real in the water. It was a great visual, I thought. It's quite an image.
His foundation laid in the holy mountain.
And then I had this fun idea. I thought, that was the best way of killing this guy. We just see him, his head being pulled away. And to this great Stan Winston sequence that we shot, where we see the Predator at work making his trophies, and we worked out, you know, what he would really need, and sort of alien versions of forensic tools to clean up the object, what our hunters would use in different ethnic areas around the world to prepare their trophies. And then Stan had this great idea, of course, of seeing the alien's skull in there, which we used to see very clearly in that shot, but now we don't see the alien skull till much later on, towards the end.
This is Tony Pope, live from L.A., City of Fear.
Where the psycho vigilante killer continues his daily diet for murder. Bodies strung out, bodies with the skins ripped off, the hearts torn from the cadaver.
Morton was so excited about being in this film. He worked really hard. He was so much fun on the set. He'd always keep everyone making jokes and having a good time.
From the body, a fitting demise to the Prince of Powder.
First Danny, then came Willie, and you were right there. He's playing with you, Mike. You've got to be careful.
Yeah, we all got to be careful. What about Keith? Anything there?
There's definitely something slippery about our brother Keith. Seems there's a Peter J. Keith, PhD, physical sciences, Cornell.
That looks like a scene about gratuitous sex. And girls in tight costumes.
Commissioned as a captain in Air Force Intelligence.
Mike, this is a dead end. We're way out of our league.
Look, I don't care how big this is or who's involved. This guy killed Danny, and he's gonna fall. Now, what about the Gadot?
I remember how expensive it was then, too, to create all these computer graphics, because, you know, once again, it was just starting out. People hadn't really been doing it for that long. Cameron had been doing it heavily in his movies and a couple of other bits and pieces, but we really went to town, and it was a gigantic budgetary thing, because unlike now, where it's so easy to do on any laptop, then you had to create all these programs. And of course, that's the history of visual effects films. And anyway, as soon as someone's done it on one film, that opens up doors to the next movie in terms of programs that already exist and can then be worked on.
Yeah, watch
it, man. Oh, this is a very conveniently placed hunting taxidermy shop, which is in downtown. Not sure if there'd be that much of that down there, really.
All right, now I just want you to stay in the car, okay?
Your mom. Okay, this is that great big huge cemetery in West Hollywood. Right.
Come on, honey.
Yes, dear.
Which way was it?
Down here, to the right.
Well, we decided to do Jim and John Thomas had written a sequence where, because this is a sequel, you had to kind of find out a little bit more about the Predator. And part of the character, I guess, is only really to hunt creatures that are worth hunting. So we gave him some sort of character, which I guess wasn't in the first film, because in the first film, there were just soldiers everywhere and he was just taking everyone out. And of course, we were feeding him lines that he could use later on. There's something quite sinister about the want some candy line.
You come on right this minute. Mommy, I don't go.
Want some candy?
Now the Predator's baiting him, which once again gives him more character than the first. He's actually starting to become involved with the characters to a certain extent. Danny looks very sweaty here. We decided to make the future very hot and sweaty. I guess we pre-saw global warming in some interesting way. Look at that gun. Danny was so big, we tried to find a gun which wouldn't look minute in his giant hands. So I think it was a Desert Eagle 457 Magnum automatic, which we added all this gear to, laser sights and stuff.
Damn, he's killing me, man.
Hey, it's me! I look great!
And now we're shooting on the subway set, which was built at Fox. And the exteriors of the moving train were shot in Oakland, California, and the Concorde. And once again, it looks like we're back into an 80s rock video.
After you. Excuse me, police business. Get out of my way.
All right, I got
it. These guys are bad.
You look like a sympathetic.
I remember this is, what had happened back in, just before the film was made, there was a guy in New York who pulled a gun and shot someone who was trying to mug him in the subway, and it was a really big legal case, whether he was allowed to defend himself or not. And I think the writers kind of tried to feed that into this version. And it became about guns. And as we know, there are a lot of them in the United States.
Okay, everybody, just take a deep breath.
It's just been the comedy of this is quite interesting in a dark kind of way. Fucking
baby. Drop it and sit down. Damn it!
Stand off. There's so difficult to shoot some of this stuff. When you're 7'3" like Kevin Peter Hall and you're in this giant rubber suit which weighs about 100 pounds, trying to get around in these areas was really difficult. We chose a sequence. We did a sequence where we had mirrors reflecting very powerful xenon lights, and so actually it would we didn't fill like the subway train set at all. We just let lights come and go, and so there are really big black sequences in the film, and it was really interesting to edit it because it was literally not lit when the light wasn't there, and it was lit when it was. It was a beautifully lit sequence by Peter. Really effective and really panicky. Because once again, we're going to try and go for what the feeling of this would be like. It's my idea of hell, I think, this kind of claustrophobic setting for something like this. And so we'd be shooting in Oakland and we'd be having mannequins of dead bodies hanging out windows that went fly past, and we'd be putting sparks on the tracks to try and make it visually interesting and show the speed of it. Bill's big moment coming up. Little joke there as the Predator smashes the TV screen. And it was really complicated effects stuff here to do an invisible Predator, which is lit. The lighting was moving so fast, it was so difficult to work on. It was a great piece of visual effects work. I think we undercranked the stuff in Oakland to make it look like we're going even faster. And the whole set had to move. I guess it's a screen tradition that monsters, even though we know they can move really fast, move really slowly when necessary. So we can see them on the screen for plenty of time. And Bill going down fighting.
Come on, you do it, Mother! Run out!
Come on, motherfucker!
What's your candy?
What's that?
Shot the train going to a halt in an area where they kept all the trains in Oakland, so we could stop and start trains, and shot some of it in reverse so it could come shuddering to a halt and all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of the trains don't do what you want them to do because they're controlled by computers to be safe. This sequence was built on another stage at Fox, so the stopped train is a considerable set, and we reused it for different sections coming up. And once again, the next scene by the Thomas Brothers was to show something about the Predator's intent and code of honor or ethics. I think this scene starts out in such a way as you're pretty sure how it's going to end, but it ends a different way. It was hard doing all these sequences one after the other and trying to give them a different feeling and some kind of different sense of tension. Because you know when you're peeking anywhere here, there's going to be blood all over the place, and some character you know is going to have had it. So we don't try and show too much of the details of things. It's not the intent, really, even though there's blood everywhere, as usual.
Oh.
could take a real sonic picture of an embryo and manipulate it to look like the rest of the visual effects there. Because, in case you haven't noticed, Maria Conchita's character is pregnant, which is why he doesn't kill her. Once again, this is shot downtown. And because it's a Larry Gordon and Joel Silver movie, there's every police car and ambulance in the whole of Los Angeles crammed into a street. A lot of their films consisted of that, I think. The main producers on the film, too, were Lloyd Levin and Michael Levy. And Lloyd Levin has carried on making lots of films with Larry, recently Hellboy and a bunch of other movies. Now, Michael Levy still works with Larry, too. And this is the beginning of the big, long chase scene. It starts here and goes right across town. It was quite a feat to pull this next section off.
Where's Jerry?
I don't know. We found his badge.
Who got hit this time?
5 gang members. A bunch of commuters. Doesn't make sense.
They were all armed.
What do you mean?
It's a Jeep.
Wait here. Yeah.
What the hell's going on down there?
It's a damn nightmare. Civilians this time. Yeah, just like the others.
There are so many convenient plot sections in the film where only our characters see the signs and no one else does. So I tried to make a lot of scenes so chaotic that it helped you believe that it was possible. This movie was given a NC-17 rating. It was the first movie ever to be given that. We were like a test case, and I remember we went back with cuts over 20 times. They were horrified by the film. The gruesomeness and the blood and scenes like this where you see someone's head and spine being pulled out of his body. But I was trying to show these things in a way which wasn't too convenient, because you can't really do close-ups of that, because you end up as a different kind of horror movie altogether. But finally, we managed to get it down to an R rating, because at that point you couldn't have an NC-17 release, and I guess even nowadays you can't. It was quite a considerable sequence too, because obviously once again all the damage is being done without anyone there, and everything is being moved and smashed in, and people reacting to stuff that we put in months and months later with the real Kevin Peter Hall in his Predator suit running around blue screens and different coloured suits. Okay, it's that time. And I think I remember actually a cheer when that happened. Morton Downey had made himself suitably unpopular. They had very little money for big sections of this film. To try and do a car chase in nighttime in Los Angeles, and nighttime anywhere, is very expensive, because everything has to be lit and you have to see so much stuff. And the stunt coordinator and second unit director did a great job of just putting little bits and pieces, and we had to try and tie in some interesting beats, like the Predator running across a neon sign, just to kind of make you feel he really was chasing properly. And then this was this great Art Deco building downtown. We put on those gargoyles and him climbing up that side of that. He was on wires. Harrigan is just about behind him, and it's time for Gary Busey to make a return. This was kind of the poster was based on this shot. And we did this sequence with lighting and all sorts of different stuff. We actually took cameras all over the city and shot day and night, and then just used different time exposures from the locked off cameras to create those big wide shots, which were very grand and very like old Universal horror movies. Now we're getting into high tech land. Some of the ideas coming up, which were very sophisticated and they were hard to explain.
Don't you show up in the damnedest places.
Come here, Lieutenant. I got something you might find interesting.
And now, of course, Gary Busey is going to explain everything.
I tell you, you don't know what you're dealing with. There's your killer. Wonderful, isn't it? Pheromone signature left by his body. These are scent molecules. Punch up three. 10 years ago, one of his kind stalked and eliminated an elite special forces crew in Central America. There were two survivors. They indicated that when trapped, the creature
activated. This is the actress who played in the original film. We have a tiny moment with her coming up, I think, and of course referring to the giant explosion that happened at the end of the first Predator movie.
World life forms.
Huh?
A fucking alien. Iwo Jima, Cambodia, Beirut, drawn by heat and conflict. He's on safari. Lions, the tigers, the bears. Oh, my.
Only Gary can deliver a line quite like that.
This is his jungle.
So why can't we see him?
Defensive adaptations are astounding. It's somehow able to bend light.
God, look how funny the old-fashioned those computer graphics look.
Not what he does, Lieutenant. For what he is. For what he can give us. A new era of scientific technology. I've waited a lifetime for this, and I'm not going to miss the chance.
It's interesting. I think in the 80s there were a lot of movies made about how the government were trying to, you know, manipulate and hide the facts from society in general.
It's taken us over 2 weeks to learn his patterns. He comes here every 2 days to feed.
So he has, the Predator has comes to the slaughterhouse and basically hangs out here, and that's who they've tracked with cameras all over the city.
One spectrum of light. Infrared.
Infrared?
He hunts by seeing our heat.
Block the heat and he's blind. These suits insulate all body heat, making the team invisible to the creature.
We flooded the packing house with radioactive dust. We've also installed powerful ultraviolet lighting everywhere. The dust...
Pretty brilliant concept, really. Of course, it turns out to be wrong, because the Predator can see in all sorts of frequencies of light.
Asshole, you're gonna freeze him.
Well, we have to capture him.
He's moving.
Finally. Grab a seat. Enjoy the show. This is history. Now we're getting
here, buddy. This sequence is very complicated. We've got video cameras everywhere, and trying to shoot video cameras, and to create a sequence where they all get attacked. It's believable that you see from not only the camera points of view, but also from film camera point of view too. So from video and film at the same time, from POVs and from the film point of view. It's a big warehouse downtown that Larry and his crew turned into this giant slaughterhouse. It was a really big build. It was a great job. And of course all the meat is not real, so we couldn't have it sitting there but day after day in the heat. So all the hanging beef had to be created, which is another expensive item. And we had to find a way of shooting which looked like ultraviolet, even though it wasn't. And we had to put a lot of dust in the air in order for these beams to read. And it was, we had to have oxygen standing by and stuff, because it was pretty brutal stuff to breathe.
What's all this interference?
Cracking the problems.
And then we had to find a way of how video could see in that same lighting. You know, when you work with these kind of extreme colors, then film reacts badly to it, so we had to do lots of tests. You have to have, always have to have sort of a white lighting in there as well, just to, in order to balance out the blue, otherwise the film doesn't know how to accept it a lot of the time. And of course, you're trying to show geography and see what the place really looks like, which is tough in this lighting, so it was quite a feat to tell any story under these circumstances. But at the same time, we also wanted it to be feel as if you couldn't really see anything, so we didn't want to give too much away. It's always that fine line. And because of these video monitors, of course, we had to really do a lot of editing. You know, Mark Goldberg had to pre-edit a lot of stuff, so what we were seeing fitted in with what we were shooting, even though we sort of had to shoot it roughly at the same time. So it was, and some of the feeds were live and incredibly complicated in those days anyway.
We're moving to the second level. Target's still moving, heading towards the number two stairwell.
Playing right into it.
There's not too many times in the film you see the predator actually running, because it's quite a difficult thing to do in that costume, so we had to really plan any movement at all, but Kevin was so powerful and strong. He was really the only person who could pull off this stuff. Again, trying to tell a story in a way where seeing from Predator's point of view and you can't see anything. And we had to work on all these different graphic points of view coming up. He starts flicking through his visual armory. We had to work out all sorts of different looks. So that's his infrared look, and the only things that have any heat are still the lamps. In the last film, this armband has been what set off the atomic explosion, and now it's this general monitor. And we start setting off different looks. We put different sounds, different looks. And finally, he sees the beams of light. And you can tell he's very excited by that.
It's moving back against the wall. It's backing up. It's moving away from them.
Looks like a video, an old video game, doesn't it?
Sir, it's circling around behind them.
Get them out, Garber! They're walking into a trap! Get them out!
And of course, the government people are fools. They don't know what to do.
Right behind the third floor structure, right there.
Who is this? Clear the line.
He sees the damn light! Turn him off! Turn him off!
Shit!
Stop him!
Time for Danny to kick some ass.
Do it. Open it.
Go fuck yourself.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
You don't know what you're doing, Harrigan.
It's open.
You'll ruin it!
Fuck yourself!
That's the 100th fuck yourself in the film, I think.
Everyone else lost the role.
This is it.
So now we have them lined up in a nice big circle. It's very difficult editing here. You want to try and do this whole sequence where Glover's getting ready to go in and sort it out. At the same time, you're trying to set tension inside.
Garber, where is he? I can't see him.
So the steady cam work in this film.
God damn it, where is he? Oh, give me a coordinate. Where is he?
Now, where we had to use, obviously, some stuntmen suits for some of this stuff on wires, because it was just such a difficult thing to do. And so, we had to, you know, do all sorts of size changes. The stuntmen were obviously nowhere near as big as the real predators. But with this kind of chaotic form of shooting, we were managed to sort of create a sense of real battle and darkness and confusion. And Danny's still getting dressed. We need to see some of this stuff with Danny just so you know, he's wearing Kevlar and stuff, so when he gets hit by the Predator, he doesn't get killed later. Here's another new fabulous device. Oh, it actually was in the first film, but we just updated it a wee bit, so. We fired rockets on wires, and that enabled all that stuff to happen. There's a lot of that, more of that coming up now, and in the story, the sprinklers come on, which make the Predator impossible to stay visible.
They're gone. They're all dead.
Obviously, we shoot the Predator from low down to make him even bigger a lot of the time, and there's his extendable lance. It was great. Winston guys kind of allow. I really wanted this stuff to work as much as possible, so I didn't have to have different shots for every part of this equipment working, and they really got a lot of it working really well, even whether we shoot it in reverse or whatever. And it's a very difficult thing they had to pull off, and they didn't want to do it, and they eventually just really got almost all the equipment working for real. You know, you have a ton of robotics people standing around with different radio controlled devices making all this stuff work, and the lasers worked, and the shoulder cannon actually, you know, unfolded and did everything it was going to do. It made filming much more interesting. It means you could shoot things in longer takes and make you feel like it's more believable, I think. The orders make it impossible to go back to invisibility, which is, once again, just a sort of a better version of the effects that they had in the first film, just because we had the time and money to experiment with it and take their versions of stuff. Joel Hynek was the same person who'd done the first film. And it was great to be able to shoot shots like that where the effects were all real. And that's right, the new little arm one. That was a new one. His little Derringer, his little side gun. Gosh, his actor spent, no, we all spent days and days in here getting soaking wet. Predator fires one more time. And it hits him on the vest, which we saw him put on. Okay, the vest is off. Ooh. We had to weigh down some of this meat stuff to make it, because it really obviously would be like a 500 pounds. We made it look tougher for Danny to move, and then we made the Predator just push things out of the way. And now we're into glowing blood, which is really difficult to shoot. And once again, so it wasn't digital, we had to try and enhance it later on, but really a lot of that was work for real, and Peter would have put ultraviolet spotlights on the areas that the bullets went off. Obviously, this is a similar moment to the first movie. And it's intended to be just that. Now, when a Predator's lying down, he doesn't look so fearsome, because, you know, to put him in the frame with someone like Danny to have the relative size to understand how huge the Predator is. But when you have four shortened shots like this, he looks small. You have to think about things like this all the time. This is where we reveal the Predator's face for the first time in this film, which is a much more sophisticated version again, where the Winston team, John and Stan and everyone, had really worked on the face and give it much more character and a lot more movable features without, you know, going away from the character they designed in the first film. Thank you. obviously need a remote control. A couple of $100,000 piece of equipment like that, you can't have water all over it, so I think that's to be factored in. That's a great face, isn't it? Now the Predator doesn't have his helmet for the rest of the film. And it's great to be able to shoot like that with the face really working, the eyes all moving. I'm trying to remember how Kevin could see. I think there was some kind of eye holes for him. Maybe not in the close-ups, but in the wide.
Guess who's back?
There's this gentleman, gosh, I can't remember his name for the life of me, I'll find out though, who came and did all the Predator's voice. And he had a kind of language worked out from the first one, which is fascinating, which is a bunch of clicks from different types of animals. And here it comes, the mighty Predator Frisbee. It is a very complicated piece of equipment which lit up and did all the right stuff again. And we had to work out a way of showing how it worked, you know, so we'd see it slice through the meat and then we'd see Gary Busey's legs drop into frame. And there was a form of boomerang would come back to the Predator, it was controlled by him. But it was a great piece of equipment. Now you never see it to this really critical point of the film. And it's interesting how you spend all this time and money working something out and you just throw it away in a small sequence like that. It's the best way to use that kind of stuff. You don't concentrate so much on it. Just like it's a part of his natural equipment. Shooting this sequence on top of this hotel downtown again. And I remember we were shooting away and we were upsetting some of the residents again, even though he'd asked for permission, obviously. And we heard gunshots come back, and we thought people were firing back at us, and maybe they were, but we never found out who it was. And once the guns started firing, people started yelling and firing guns back, or just firing guns in the air somewhere. It would have been easier in a way to shoot this on a set, but it was just too expensive. And it was nice to have all those buildings in the background which looked real rather than sort of a fake translite. So we've injured the Predator, and he hasn't got his mask, and now he has a breathing apparatus. And we see him. So we're trying to make him feel like he's weaker. And now he's lost his spear. And I'd try and work out a way that I thought that this was possible. So we made him feel sickly and he's taking big breaths. And then he goes to use his weapon against him. This next sequence took forever, as you can imagine. And we've got the real Danny Glover on wires hanging over this precipice, about 10 stories up, with the stuntman Predator who we're trying to make look as big as possible.
Okay, pussy face. It's your move.
Shit happens.
So the Predator's hanging from that. His frisbee that he's plunged into the wall, and now he goes to use the very familiar weapon from the first film. We had to work out this sequence carefully. I don't think it was written quite like this in the first place, and we just had to work out how to make this sequence work, that he could be hanging, and then Danny could reach the weapon, and He's about to blow up Los Angeles with a nuclear weapon. And trying to work out sound effects to let the audience know, in case they hadn't seen the first film, that this is a bomb. Because otherwise he wouldn't know at all. And he cuts off the brother's arm. And this stunt guy was on what's called a descender. I was saying he used his, you know, his hand and feet to slow himself down. And in a lot of movies that Larry and Joel did, I think it was more Joel's influence, you'd often find a sequence where the action would go into someone's real household, whether it was a Lethal Weapon or Die Hard. You'd end up in a very ordinary situation, and the sequence is really good science fiction, I think. You see him ending up in just a bathroom of an apartment, and him using equipment to create sort of battlefield medicine, where he uses tiles and mirrors, the silica from mirrors and different things, to create bandages and for himself, and to cauterize the wound. We've set up right at the beginning of the film that Danny's supposed to have a fear of heights. As you can tell, a lot of this is shot on location, a lot of it's shot in tiny different sets and studios all over the place. But mainly at Fox, obviously, little sections here and there. So storyboarding to death. And he takes off another backpack piece we haven't seen before and opens up his medical kit, which is beautifully designed again with the pieces of equipment.
Yeah, maybe I get lucky and fall.
And even with his giant gloves and stuff on, once again Kevin shows what a master he is of kind of dexterity to be able to make that stuff look. You know, when you've got huge hands and then you've got giant rubber gloves on top to be able to pull up this kind of minute detail, it's quite a feat. I think we like the sequence so much, at one point we talked about using just this for the trailer in a way. It's just such an interesting, well thought out piece of work by the writers. To see a monster acting like a soldier and having a completely different technology to adapt it and to see him in a situation that's really ordinary. And going back to what I said before, if you look at a lot of the movies from Harry Gordon and Joel Silver at the time, you'd end up in someone's house. And this actress was hilarious, like this little old lady. They're watching TV where the husband is asleep. And so we're in the middle of this really powerful science fiction sequence. You add this kind of realistic comedy, or likely Broadway comedy, I guess. Call a hypodermic. Some of the Winston's best work, I think. And it's great to be able to use the Predator's facial expression so much. In the first movie, you know, it just wasn't used at all. You hardly ever saw him. And I think you have to offer more in a sequel. And this great guy. She comes in with a broom ready to take care of the problem. Of course, Danny's dropped his gun.
It's all right, I'm a cop.
I don't think he gives a shit.
Get back inside!
this was in a hotel downtown, which we were out to use the elevator shaft.
Holy moly, stop again, shit!
Some Wonderland idea here that at the bottom of the elevator shaft, you know, it's the elevator's coming down, but it's how the predator gets down to his ship. The ship's underground in some kind of old sewer in LA, and you don't realize it till you get there. So this exterior of the ship was built on one of the big Fox stages, and it's enhanced by glass paintings, I think. Glass or matte paintings. So you see him stand up there, and that's mostly a matte, which is beautifully painted, I think. Once again, all the ship's design sort of in similarity to the Predator's costume and stuff. These were backlit fiberglass sections that were constructed by Larry, and the whole ship feels kind of organic, like you're inside a snail shell or something. And I was pleased with the stuff. It really felt different. It was very difficult to light and make it feel that it had a reality to it, but it was so unusual and kind of mystical and in some ways kind of inspired by some of the old Mayan representations of gods, you know, which some people think were extraterrestrials anyway, that the Mayans had contact with them. But at the same time, like all technology, has an artistic quality to it. You know, if you look at any aircraft now or any machines that people use all the time, whether they're cars or not, of course people want them to be artistically pleasing too, so there's that sensation of that. And of course there's the alien skull over here that stands stuck up on the wall. We put some great skulls up here, and originally we saw it in the first sequence when the Predator takes the Jamaican's head and cleans it, but we decided to leave it till the end in case it became too distracting, thought it'd be part of the story. There it is right there. A lot of fans noticed it and a lot didn't. And there's some good old-fashioned human skulls. And then the same neck weapon that we saw at the start of the film. And we reckoned the only way he could fight the Predator was with a weapon of the Predator's caliber. Very difficult sequence to film. I'm trying to put a normal human being up against a monster like this and try to be convincing. We added a lot of the sparks and effects later. Obviously in a movie like this, sound effects are so key. See, Steve Flick did the sound effects in the movie, and he's an Academy Award winning sound effects editor, and had done and you know, if you remove the sound effects from this film, there's so little of the sound left. The Predator's a bit beaten and arrogant. We used all sorts of animal sounds, I think, for the Predator here. We used, I think, gorillas as well as large cats, you know, like lions and tigers, and it was a great sound mix. Harder than than it looks when you're 7'6" with an 8-foot costume on to fall backwards. We have to be really careful we didn't hurt Kevin in that. And then he has to fall back into dry ice, which is not something you want to be breathing too much. Of course, leaving the audience to expect one thing. The blood's flowing very well, isn't it? Is it dead? Ooh, look at all the goo everywhere. I think every day Danny Glover was covered in sweat, blood, goo, whatever. And now the final blow. Very expensive shot and a very difficult shot to do, and you've got creatures, you know, and they're all walking in dry ice, and we did it originally as one shot, and we had, I think, 9 or 10 predators, and Danny was we used to have the Lakers on one monitor for Danny to watch. I think he persuaded a couple of Lakers to come along to be able to cover these guys.
Okay, who's next?
And now each, not that you can see it, you know, unless you really study it, but each of these predators have different costumes, armor, styles, different trophies hanging from their belts. And I guess we learned that if you kill a predator off, you get some kind of award. The main predator here, standing here, once again, if you look closely, he seems more aged than the others, and he has some great bits and pieces hanging from his costume. It's a very smart design. So they give him his trophy, which shows they've been around, going around for years and years. It's a clever final touch, I think. One of the really smart bits of plotting of this film, I think. So the ending's not just about him defeating another creature. It takes it one step further. We did some camera shaking here, and we added some afterwards. Giant light rig here, actually in a real sewer in downtown LA, to a scene that's pretty familiar now. I think in movies a hero running away from a giant fireball. Beautifully shot and lit, I think. And Danny, of course, is now covered with more goo and stuff than ever. Dust, blood, predator goo, all sorts of shit. Beautiful music from Alan here. Alan went off, you know, has done hundreds of films. I've done several more films with him. He's a wonderful composer. I remember, I think one of his great scores is the score for The Abyss, Jim Cameron film. Once again, we're downtown LA. Looking for the final coda of the film. Glover looks great here, this beaten warrior. And there's something so interesting about the urban environment, you know, and the, how this all took place right in the heart of just a leftover tough part of town.
Harrigan! What the fuck happened in there? Ah!
Don't worry, assholes. You'll get another chance.
That's a pretty good ending, isn't it? Leaves it sort of up in the air without, you know, a sequel as you can get without being too obvious, I think. Good existential sense of futility at the end and sort of success at the same time. I like that last shot. It could be a spaceship, could be whatever. Hooray, finally my credit. Now we want to put all the credits at the back because we wanted to dive into the movie to begin with. Friend Peter Levy, I've been shooting movies with for 20 years now. Larry Paul, one of the great designers. Mark Goldblatt, one of the great action editors of all time. Great guy. Anyway, I hope you had a good time watching it again. And I guess there's going to be more Predators coming your way. Okay,